Hi, everybody, and welcome to another new edition of Live from Pawnee. I'm Alan, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you, sir?
Well, good morning, Sir Alan of the Roundtable. I'm doing excellent, I must say. How are you?
I'm doing good. I will be the judge of whether you're doing excellent or not.
Oh, well, that's always fair, I suppose.
Anyway, Mark, we're here today to talk about our interview with Jim Meskimen.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know why?
Why?
Because on account of, I'll tell you why. Because this episode is a
Live from Pawnee presents Pawnee Spotlight.
That's right, Mark. We have another Pawnee Spotlight. You know, episode 7.9, Primary, right? Had so many guest stars, right? I mean, it's probably, it's kind of our, the big ta-da at the end here is they literally wrap up the entire series. And of course, guest stars have been such a big part of this show and big part of our lives now for the last 3.5 years. I haven't counted, but I know we're in our 20s on these interviews. And wow, that's all I can say is wow. It's just been, it's something I never imagined we would do, but we've had a fabulous time doing it.
Yeah, you're right. You know, here at the end of the series, they're often going to pull out all the stops as far as guest stars and as well they should, because it's not just for nothing. It's often characters, it's regularly characters are fan favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one had a lot. This one definitely had a lot. So
yes. You notice there what I did. You remember earlier when you heard me go, "Whoa, Doc, that's heavy."
Uh-huh.
So that's really you and I both know, and our fan knows, I'm really good at impressions.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the right answer is just for you to nod your head.
I mean, you're no Jim Meskimen, but yes, you're pretty good at impressions.
I'm not even in the same league as Mr. Meskimen, but yes, that's I was looking forward to this interview very, very much, because apparently, didn't know if you were aware of this, Alan, he does a lot of voices. Holy cow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, if you look at his credits, there's a giant number of them. So many voice acting roles, and he's just like, you know, he can do them all. Like I'm not sure I think with effort, there's probably not a voice he could not do.
I agree. I was absolutely dumbfounded Alan, I think you might be in the same boat as I was, that you were first familiar with who he was through Parks and Rec.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I realized that I was very, very familiar with his voice. I want to say easily a decade before, because he did voices of two of the characters that I love from the great video game series Baldur's Gate.
See, I heard you guys talking about that, and while I was fascinated for you, I don't know what that is.
You like to hide your nerd card. You don't display it proudly on your sleeve like I do. But
I said, like fantastic. While you were doing that stuff, I dated. So, you know, that's what I like to say.
Yeah, okay. That's what we're going to do now. Okay.
I wish it were true. It's funny, but I wish it were true. Yeah. No, he's done a lot of video games. And like you said, going back many years, you know, Jim's like our age. So he's had a pretty decent long career already. And he's really, like I said, kind of done it all. Like in my mind, probably because he does a bad Johnny Carson on purpose in one of the Parks and Rec episodes. I think the first one, in fact, he just, you know, he's got that Carson-esque ability to kind of just slip from voice to voice. And you know, not that Johnny Carson was great at it, but Jim is.
Oh, well, yeah.
He could have a four-way conversation and he's all four voices.
Oh,
I mean,
flawlessly. I completely agree.
I mean, that goes on in my head, but no one can hear that.
Well, and you know what? Not only that, everything you said is 100% true, but he also had pretty interesting childhood growing up.
He did. Yeah. Now we'll get into that in the interview and learn about kind of like him growing up in Hollywood and his mom who we love, and you'll get to hear a little bit about that. So I've been looking forward to airing this interview, and it's another one. We just had a great time talking to Jim, and I think we should maybe let the interview speak for itself.
I think you're right. Let's do it.
All right. Well, everybody, no further ado, our interview with Jim Meskimen.
Thank you.
Well, Mark, we have a terrific special guest today. He has over 320 credits across a combination of television, movies, video games, and shorts. You know him as Pawnee's own favorite master of ceremonies, Martin Housley. Please welcome the very talented Jim Meskimen.
Hey, Jim.
Here he is. Hi, Jim.
Am I in? It says stop video start. Okay, I get it. You'd think I'd only done one Zoom broadcast in my whole life. What is this? Where are you? I can't see you.
Get off my lawn.
What's happening?
That was me about 2 minutes before you jumped on, and we've done this at least 30 times now. So,
yeah.
Oh, boy. Oh, well.
Technology, it's fantastic.
It is. It really is.
What? It's a gift from the gods.
Although you clearly have the better audio recording setup there, which I love.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah, I do a quite a fair amount of stuff in this booth. So
I bet.
I sprung for it. Yeah. All during the pandemic, I was doing audiobooks and Colonel Sanders for the KFC brand. I was the voice of Colonel Sanders quite a while. Still waiting for them to come back. Yeah. If we got my park is bad for some reason, I'm not sure why. Yeah. I did a Star Trek game in here and just tons of stuff. Bunch of Beavis and Butthead episodes.
Oh, I'm gonna fanboy so hard. I did not realize I have a secret guilty pleasure, Jim, of the Baldur's Gate series. I had no idea that you did Khalid and Edwin. I was like, oh my gosh, that is so cool.
Edward Adesseron, yes, it was sort of modeled a little bit on John Malkovich, I think, but if he was a little more posh and. It's a long time ago.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Such a good job.
Thank you. Yeah, wow. I've been doing this a long time. A lot of voice acting. I got into acting through voice acting, basically. And I got into voice acting through cartooning. So I've always been just, in the arts, just up to my neck. And Sometimes I'm very comfortable with it. Other times I'm like, what the hell am I going to do next week? You caught me in one of those periods, unfortunately, where I'm like, oh my God, what's happening?
Well, Jim, thanks so much for joining us again today. This is, we've been looking forward to this, and we're actually, our podcast has been on for, gosh, Mark, what, almost a little over three and a half years now. And we are finally up to the last three episodes. We're doing Pie Mary, which was, I think, your last episode, and I think we're three from the end. So,
right. Gosh, I guess that was my last episode. Yeah. Pie eating contest. Yeah.
As the great Martin Housley. So
Martin Housley. Yeah. I always enjoyed playing that character. It's so much fun being on the show.
What's your strongest memory of Parks and Recreation this many years later?
Well, it just seems like, like last year or 2 years ago, but of course it's probably now 7 or 8 years ago. I don't know. When I think about Parks and Rec, I think vividly about the first time I ever did it. And that was when it was a show that nobody had ever heard of. And I was just hired for one episode. I remember auditioning and then driving up to go to the mountains, I think, and then having to come back because I got the part. I don't know how that worked exactly, but we shot in a local hotel here in, I think it was in Glendale, and they had a room full of extras, and I met Amy. She was very nice, and I think I met Rashida. I don't remember meeting too many other people, but the great thing was that they let me improvise a lot. Not that they used any of it particularly, but that they encouraged it and were interested. And that was a fun show. The Tellenson Awards.
Oh yeah.
And I had a nice joke. I had a nice kind of dry joke that I got to make, that the writers constructed beautifully. And some years later, in fact, just a couple years ago, Rob Lowe got on some podcast, and the only reason I know about it. Rob Lowe went on and on about my character in that episode, unsolicited. And somebody contacted me and said, hey, Rob Lowe just gave you a lot of love about this. And I had to look it up, and I'm like, he talked about how what I had done was he admired it so much at the timing. And I don't know. He said, this is a masterclass, he said, in comedy. I'm like, wow, this is very, these are very big words. So I sought out his mailing address, or his, I got somebody to send him a beautiful tree, like a pomegranate tree, bonsai. Aww. Because I was like, that's a pretty nice thing to do, you know, to reach Absolutely. Out like that. And
yeah.
The host apparently knew my name. And but I just remember any time I worked on it, I guess I did about 7 episodes in all. Not all of them aired, but I think 6 of them did. Anytime I was on, they would say, okay, Jim, we need Martin to be talking in the background, because, you know, they would always have the talking heads at the event speaking, you know, more intimately, and they needed... Sure. Just sort of background, walla, noise, possible things. And so I would, you know, I'm an improviser, so I'm happy to do it. But I, you know, I had enough time so I could kind of scribble down some ideas and some notes. And they would let me go on for minutes and just do Martin Housley talking about the event and the people, some of the people there. And I just felt so fortunate. And then they'd actually listen, and people would applaud and laugh and so forth. It's kind of like, you know, this is not usual. this doesn't happen on a lot of TV episodes. Normally, the line I get, the direction I get as a guest star in any given television show that I might be hired to be on is, yeah, Jim, it's great. Can you do it like 30% faster? Which is, you know, them saying, you know, your part is so unimportant and we're just trying to improve it. You deliver a piece of information that's that big that we need, and all the rest is, you know, the acting part and the stuff that you were interested in. Yeah, let's make that as small and unnoticeable as possible. Can you do that? And after 35 plus years of being in this business, you know, the next time they say, can you do it faster? I just go, ugh, there it is again. Another arrow.
That's weird, because they were asking me and Mark to do the same thing at work. So, yeah. Can you just do it faster, cheaper?
Just do it cheaper. Yeah.
Yes.
Don't involve so much of your own viewpoint in it.
It's leave your personality out and just, you know, do the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys don't really have one. Just what you do, leave it out.
Yeah. Who cares?
Yeah. We've actually heard from a lot of the people that we've been fortunate enough to interview that they were, you know, you guys were given a lot of creative control. And there was a fun run, I believe it was called, that they often let you do and come up with like different approaches to stuff or ability to say different stuff. That's just really neat.
Yeah. You know, it's very generous, and it's part of the whole recipe of what made that show so fun. And, you know, at about season 5, I began to realize that because I was not a consumer of the show. I don't really watch a lot of TV. I work on shows, and then I'm like, I can't be bothered. I'm doing other things. I have a live show. I have my own silly projects, and I just don't watch a lot of shows. So my daughter told me, you know, she was watching Parks and Rec religiously, and she said, Dad, you know, this is a really good show. And I said, oh, is it? And then I started watching. I was like, holy crap, this is a really good show. I'm on a really good show. What's going on here? So then the next time I worked on it, I asked one of the producers, I said, how did you get away with creating a good show? Because, you know, there's all kinds of barriers to putting on a good show on network television. Sure. And it's a miracle. Of magnitude when a show is actually a decent, interesting, fun, and creative, lighthearted show, in my experience. And he said, you know, we just flew under the radar. They just didn't pay a lot of attention to us. And I went, well, man, more power to you. That is great. So the whole thing about inviting people's participation and allowing them to be kind of creative and interesting and outside the box is part of that whole mojo that the show had, which I guess you have to credit the creators and Amy and whoever was in an executive position who not only allowed it to happen and inspired it to happen, but defended it somehow by putting a big bubble around the show, because we're all the beneficiaries of that.
Yeah. That's well said. I mean, Greg Daniels and Mike Schur are obviously the creators. I think Mike was at the helm, you know, Greg was executive producing, but Mike was there, Amy was there and set a lot of the tone, you know. I think we've heard so much from so many people about how this show was just, you know, lightning in a bottle was what someone described it as, right? It was just so different. Yeah. And for a network show that has to be compressed into 21 and a half minutes, that's just incredible.
It is. And I'm sure by this time, the network has taken major steps to make sure that nothing like that ever happens again. But we certainly did enjoy it. Yeah.
Wow.
Jim, did you find when you initially went into audition for the part, I was curious, what sort of a flavor did they give you for what kind of knucklehead this, you know, Martin Housley is?
Well, he wasn't so much of a knucklehead in the first one. I mean, he was just an MC in this small town. Sorry for all that pinging. You know, the gag was worked into the script. You know, he was this announcing the person for whom the award was a memorial to, who was, you know, on this just barely alive, and motioning from his hospital bed or something. And so it was that kind of slightly black humor, and it was, I understood it very well. I've actually done a lot of emceeing and part of and spokesman-y type things for commercials and events and things where, you know, you present yourself as the typical, you know, authoritative kind of good host, and then we, you know, you reveal by one trick or another that, you know, you're actually, you know, weird, or you say things inappropriately, or you're a goofball, or there's a lot of it's a kind of a fine line, and you can meander off that line and create comedy very easily. So as the series went on and they called me back, pretty early on, I think they wrote in something about, I think maybe it was in the beauty contest, where they wrote in something about him doing a voice or making a kind of a comment that maybe Johnny Carson would have made or something.
Right. Yeah.
And I think at that point I asked them, I said, would it be okay? Maybe Martin Housley is a kind of a amateur impressionist, like a bad impressionist. And they went, give it a shot, try it out. And again, with that loose kind of nobody's looking at the clock kind of attitude they had, I was able to, you know, spitball some stuff, and they left it in. And then it was like, oh, okay, well, this is part of Martin Housley, is that he likes to be a corny, you know, I guess you would call it dad jokes now, or an impressionist, you know, which I could do very easily and enjoyed doing. So that's kind of how that came to be. But originally he was just a straight MC who said something where you go, wait a minute, what did he just say?
I always thought that you probably did a little bit too good a job, to be honest with you, because I thought that was kind of the shtick they were going for.
Right.
I thought, he's really good. Like, I know he's supposed to be corny, but man.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, maybe it's harder to be a bad impressionist than I think.
Not for us, it's not.
No.
Maybe for you.
Well, you know, Eugene Levy had that kind of aspect to his character in one of those Christopher Guest projects where he was kind of doing, wow, that's wild, man. I'm Johnny Carson. That's wild. You know, he had some kind of thing that he did. And that was a little bit of an inspiration for it, too. I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, Jim, I know I originally reached out to you. I was watching one of your Instagram lives, and I was in the chat, and I said something, you know, how we were fans of yours. We'd love to have you on the podcast. And I also said, I meant to write that your mom is a national treasure, but Siri auto corrected me and said national treasurer. So, and you made fun of me, as you should have.
Yeah.
You probably don't remember this as your many Instagram moments, but I remember it. So it was fun. Tell us about kind of growing up in Hollywood, you know?
Yeah, I hope I wasn't too impolite.
Not at all.
Like, autocorrect is the worst, isn't it? We have an autocorrect society, I think.
Yes.
But, well, growing up with, you know, I've told this story so many times, but so, yeah, my mom, who was just my mom, was a working actress, like me. She started in the theater. She's a Minnesota girl. So with big dreams, you know, and very determined, very ambitious, very feisty. She was a middle child, so she kind of learned how to, I don't know, I always think of her as kind of like the artful dodger. I mean, she nobody had any attention on my mom at all, and she had to kind of, nobody got, there was no frills, so she had to fight for every little perk out there in the wilderness of Minnesota. I've been there, by the way, where she grew up, and it's, you know, it's idyllic, but kind of bleak, too, at the same time, and she just couldn't wait to get out of there and be a movie star. She would go to the movies locally and see the billboard or the marquee and picture her name and changed her name so that it would look better on that marquee. Her name was Marian, and she changed it to an O-N because that would look better. And I understand that. You know, it's an aesthetic thing that you just kind of go, this would look better. But she miraculously pursued her dream. She was on contract to Paramount at an early age. As a kind of a, I don't know, they used to have, you know, contract players who would like, well, we're going to stick you in this movie. And by the way, go to this premiere tonight. And we're going to stick you in this part here. And you're in this courtroom scene. And you'd be working, you know, a few days a month, I imagine. And you'd get paid every week and it'd be very low. And she was married young, too. And then she was released from contract. And that was like a tragedy, you know, like, oh, my God, now she's not on contract. And her whole life is very, very interesting. But it was always a no frills and a lot of ambition and not any big breaks until. And she was my parents were divorced. So she was then a feisty, ambitious single mom raising two kids. Both of whom have gone into show business unwisely. And she doubled down where a lot of people would cave and go, well, I guess I better go and be a manager at a department store. Or I don't know what the hell, you know, women did in the early 60s to like say, F it, you know, I'm going to go and get a regular paycheck now. Right. She did not do that. She doubled down. She would get commercials. She would be guest stars on things. And she, it's all in her book. She wrote a really nice book. We put her together with a ghostwriter a few years ago, and she recorded all her wonderful stories. And so I know this one very well. It's like she went into an audition. It was a crappy little part. And she used to cry a lot in those days. When I was a kid, she was pretty much always crying at least once or twice a week, just out of like frustration and just the toughness of it all, you know? And we got very, my sister and I were like, oh, there she's crying again. Are you crying? When are you going to stop crying? You know, no sympathy.
Kids.
But she went into this audition and I guess she was saying, crying and saying, I'm raising these two kids and I need a job. And, you know, like pressing it. But in a very real way. And the guy said, well, all right. I got a job that's, do you want a guest star part that's going to work 2 days? Or do you want a longer, smaller part that's going to work 5 weeks? And she said, I want the longer part. So he gave her a part in a movie called Airport, which you may recall, Burt Lancaster, Dean Martin, George Kennedy. I think he won an Oscar for something in that. And worked 5 weeks on this show, which helped to pay her SAG, you know, insurance and helped to keep us alive. And while on that shoot, she met through working her connections, she met a casting director whose name escapes me at the moment. But and that casting director, I think she had some kind of conversation with a casting director who said, you know, you might be good for this interesting pilot that Gary Marshall is casting. So she got that audition by working that and, you know, being at the right place at the right time, but also being very focused.
Persistent.
And Gary Marshall loved her and Gary Marshall hired her. And that changed our life.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That is terrific.
And I understand it now viscerally because I'm the same kind of working actor. You know, I just worked on a show with Billy Bob Thornton out in Texas, and I worked with Sean Penn and Julia Roberts a couple of years ago on Gaslit, and I, you know, I drop into Young Sheldon and The Big Bang Theory, and you know, I go around, I do the rounds, I visit these shows, and sometimes I meet people, and sometimes it's too short, and sometimes they say, "Could you just say it a little quicker?" And so I know, and then for her to then escalate and move out of that and rise to the top of that and become someone who, no matter where I go and people find out who my mom is, they go, "Oh, that's your mom? Oh, I love your mom."
Yeah.
That's the universal statement. It's just flabbergasting to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that the woman you described there certainly comes across, I think, in the part she's played. And that's probably why so many fans adore her. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, too, I'll just say one more thing about mom, and then we'll get back to the more important topic of me, my career.
Correct.
I didn't realize this until much later, but Marion, the part of Marion Cunningham, was, "Oh, dear, yes, dear, I'll have the dinner's ready." You know, it was very light.
Yeah.
And again, mom expanded that, not by improvising, but by making herself extremely useful at the weekly table read. And you probably know on a sitcom, and I think they probably did it in Parks and Rec too, although it's not a multicam show in the traditional sense, but they'll go around and they'll have a table read, which is a formal around the table with the writers and the actors, and they will read through next week's script at some point in the rehearsal process of the script that they're working on that week. And often they won't have hired all the guest stars yet or the little ancillary characters.
Mm-hmm.
So they will have, you know, just a writer or a PA read those parts. And mom said, "Well, you know, I can read those parts if you want." And they went, "Oh, great, great." So she would play those characters. And that demonstrated something about my mom, I guess, as an actress, that the writers and Gary didn't really grok, you know, they didn't understand. And so they began to get ideas from listening to her. "Oh, that's very funny," you know. And at the same time, too, I know that she was observing this sense of humor. It was male, it was Jewish, borscht belt, it was a particular kind of jokiness and humor. Mm-hmm. And she and Ron Howard, too, were both kind of going, "Oh, that's interesting." And learning that language, because it is a kind of a language. It has a rhythm to it. It has a kind of an attack to it. Yeah. It's almost like a kind of music. And so she got very indoctrinated in that because she studied it and absorbed it. And like me, as a mimic, you know. And so that also helped tremendously, I think.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that about your mom. I just, you know, I was a big fan of Happy Days. And so Ron Howard, you mentioned Ron. I mean, I'm assuming that, I think I even heard you say maybe on another podcast or an interview, were you guys friends? Is that kind of how the Apollo 13 opportunity came around for you? Because I actually remembered you from Apollo 13, believe it or not. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've known Ron for a good long time. I like to do my impression, Ron, because it's a great way to be. And, I think he does a great job at it. I met him when he was about 19. I was maybe he was 18. So I've known him a good long time. And I friends, I mean, like I don't go to his house and play basketball.
Sure.
Like he has friends. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
He has plenty of friends. He has all the friends that he needs and more. I admire him tremendously, and we've had many, many interactions. And he was nice enough to come to a few shows that I did. He came to some improv shows back in New York, and I magically ran into him on the streets of New York more than once.
Wow.
I remember one day walking somewhere on the East Side, and there's Ron Howard, and he goes, "Hey, Jim." And I'm like, "Hey, Ron, what are you doing?" "Oh, I'm shooting here. Actually, if you want to come tomorrow, we're shooting this movie called Splash, and we're shooting under the Brooklyn Bridge. So come by tomorrow morning, and I'll show you everything." So the next morning, I got up and I went down. I went to the bottom of the Brooklyn Bridge, looked around. I'm like, "What the hell? Where is it?" Turns out, I didn't. It took me a long time to figure this out. There are two places where the Brooklyn Bridge goes.
Mm-hmm.
And Brooklyn is one of the destinations. And that's the one I didn't go to. Otherwise, I could have been at that historic event, seeing that being shot. But we kept in touch. And then one day I auditioned for a movie that he was going to direct called The Paper. And it was just a small part. And I went in and there he was at the audition, which I didn't expect. You don't expect the director to be at auditions, actually. Usually they're at the callback, if at all, you know. And this was a small part, but he was there and I auditioned for him. And that was cute, too, because it's a happy story because I got the part. But if I hadn't, it would have been just a miserable story. But so I'm doing the scene. It's originally written for a guy who, it said in the script, it said a gray man in a gray suit, Tom. That was it, you know, and he's a kind of a lawyer or something. Like, wow, I wasn't gray at that time. My hair was brown. But anyway, I'm doing a scene with the actress who would eventually turn out to be Marissa Tomei. And I'm sort of hitting on her in the scene. My character is sort of hitting on her, and you know, he's kind of transparent about it. And she's married, and he's kind of hitting on her, and she wants some information, so she's putting up with it. And so that was all I knew. I hadn't read the whole script. And when I go in and I did the scene for Ron, and he said, "That's good. It's good. You realize she's 8 months pregnant." And I went, "No, I did not know that." That changes things rather a lot. Hitting on an 8-month-old pregnant woman, married, is a whole nother guy.
Yes.
Wow. So I had to make a quick adjustment, and I didn't feel like I honored it. You know, I felt like, oh, man. Afterwards, I remember writing down all these notes. Here's what you should have done. And then like a month later, they said, "Well, you got the part." And I'm like, I can't believe it. So that turned out to be my first film, thanks to my friend Ron Howard. And I know he was, and then he wrote me a really nice letter when I did it. And then he would have me back to do other things like Apollo 13, you mentioned, which was a great job and a great opportunity. And I was still one of my favorite assignments ever. And I met so many people on that shoot because I was in Mission Control, crowded, a lot of people there, all the mission controllers, all the generals, all the, you know, the men who play army people and people who play journalists. And, you know, it was just crowded all the time. And I worked on it for a month. I met Jim Lovell, the astronaut. I met real guys who had been in Mission Control that were our consultants. And then the film crew and all Ron and everybody. And yeah, Ed Harris, got to work with Ed Harris.
Yeah.
Here's the cute story about Ed Harris. So he played Gene Kranz, who's the head of Mission Control, and at least in that section, and the daylight hours or whatever. And I was excited to meet him, but I wasn't going to meet him until the day we started shooting. But the night before we were to meet at Universal, the phone rings, and it's Ed Harris. And I'm like, Ed. Wow. You know, I'm like, oh, hi, Ed. Oh, wow. You know, I'm just fanboyed out on the guy. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Oh, I'm just enjoying this moment. You just said my name. Hi. And he just sort of asked me some questions like, so you got a family? What do you like to do? And I realized, oh, he's just kind of doing a little bit of research, you know, on, he's supposed to know all these guys. And I bet he didn't even have everybody's phone number. I probably had me and a few other people. I haven't talked to, I don't remember anybody else saying, "Hey, did Ed call you last night?" But we talked for a few minutes and he went, "Well, I guess I'll see you tomorrow. We'll get this thing, get this show on the road." And I'm like, yeah, see you tomorrow, Ed. And it was just super sweet. It's a nice memory.
I bet that's not something that every star does. So he's a pretty big name at that point.
Very big name and just a lovely guy and a lovely actor. And I've watched his career ever since and just had so much admiration. I really liked The movie he did about Pollock, Jackson Pollock, he directed, wrote, and he was developing that movie script back then in Apollo 13 days, so a good 8-10 years before he shot it. And I wrote to him and I said, you know, this is a, you know, admiring, you know, what a great job I thought he did. He wrote me back and was very kind. And he's just a, you know, when we don't expect these big stars to want to engage in any human way. Yeah. We don't expect them to be able to. And when one does, because they can, it's kind of like, oh, so you're a human being like me. And it's very validating and very warm. And, you know, it gives you hope. Most of them are like that too, by the way. I mean, I haven't had that kind of interaction with many of the Oscar winners that I've worked with. I've worked with quite a few, but at least on the day, you know, when you're there with them, like I just worked with Billy Bob Thornton. And I was like, what's this going to be like? What's this guy like? You know, because who knows, you know? And I asked some people, friends of mine, have you worked with Billy Bob? What's he like? Yeah, he was great. I'm like, okay. Because sometimes in interviews, he's a little cranky.
Yeah.
but he was fantastic. And we had a wonderful time together. And he said, I understand you're an impressionist.
Oh, boy.
And so I shared a bunch of impressions with him. Burgess Meredith. He liked Burgess Meredith a lot.
Oh,
and the old timey guys he liked a lot. So hats off to you, Billy Bob Thornton.
That's terrific.
I wanted to tell you, Jim, I watched your, this is apropos of nothing, but I watched your YouTube series. This is probably from like 10 years ago. And you had made a series about how to do impressions. And yeah. I thought it was really, really good. And it was just a bunch of like short segments where you said, you know, this is how I break it down. And I was always one of those people when I was young. I was the one in my group of friends or like, I'm always imitating someone or trying to at least. So, I mean, it kind of really spoke to me. I'm curious, in your experience, how do people tend to react when they learn that you do an impression of them? Like, do they take it as a compliment or do they go like, well, wait a minute, you know, what did you pick out from what I did?
You know, I don't know exactly. I haven't met that many people that I do. I know Ron is very gracious about it. He's, you know, unfortunately heard it a few times, but I'm not like Matt Friend. I don't go up and like accost people with my impression of them saying, hey, look, this is what you sound like to me.
Right. Right.
I'm not comfortable with that. Because of growing up, with Marion and everything, I'm sensitive to that, you know, being on the receiving end of that.
Sure.
But that being said, I think I'm probably, you know, drifted over a little too far to that. I think people would probably, if it's done with respect, which I generally do.
Yeah.
Because I only really do impressions of people that I like. I drop the ones that I don't, or I find something to like about them. And then I'm not an expert in people that are just famous that everybody should do. I can't be bothered. There's too many people that I admire and like, and so it's always a bit of an homage.
That was actually one thing I remember from that series is one of the simple tips you said is, you know what, if you try to kind of get in their head and you know, look at the world through their eyes, and it's a lot easier to do that, and you enjoy it a lot more if you like that person. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I always tell that people it's just a good opening thing, because that's definitely the way I started. I see a thing and I go, oh, that's awesome. He's great. You know, oh, and then just pretend to be him. And then after a while, because then you can hear their voice in your head. You kind of can feel their body. And then you can, you know, and then it's just practice about bringing it out and presenting it as a performance kind of aspect.
That's awesome. Yeah.
How many voices are in the current version of the Jim Preston show? I know you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. Let me look here. Let's see. It's 750. Somebody's keeping this up. I don't know. I don't actually know. I don't actually know. I don't keep a good tally of it. But I would say in the realm of, I say in my show, I do about 75 voices. Wow. I've not actually counted them, to be honest. Yeah. But I also don't have a set script. So it's more or less than 75-ish. Yeah. So... And new ones all the time. I mean, my voice changes, people's voices change, celebrities change. We don't do certain people anymore. You know, things, people come on the scene. People always say things like, you know, always say, but sometimes they say, is there anybody you can't do? And I say, yeah, most people I can't do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an awful lot of people in the world, but there's about 75 in there that I can do pretty well.
Well, you need a hook, right? I mean, there's got to be some. It's like almost like a caricature for an artist, right? You know, somebody.
Yes, but I'm not much of a caricaturist, actually. I, you know, even even in my my cartooning and stuff, I'm not. That's a whole. It's a funny thing. It's, I think of myself like, oh, I could probably do a caricature of somebody, but it's not. It's a. It's almost like a different language again. You know, I am more. I've got more of a. I'm an attraction towards presenting something very accurately. And even in my artwork, I am always working from a place of more portraiture than caricature. I admire the caricaturist. It's just a different language. It's not the one that I really knuckle down in the room.
Yeah.
Wow.
But but and the idea of a hook, you know, because a lot of guys do that. They go, well, if I can get this phrase down. And I think that's a very good exploratory tool. And I have used that for sure. I remember specifically with a couple of voices, I discovered a kind of a, well, I can say these four or five words like this guy pretty good. Right. So out of that, what, you know, is that the DNA of the rest of the personality or the rest of the sound? You know, sometimes it is. Like Johnny Carson, for example, I remember very well being about 17 or 18. And I remember thinking there was a way he used to start, his writers used to write a certain kind of joke that would begin, well, it finally happened.
Yeah.
Right. And I could do, well, it finally happened.
Yeah.
And there was enough in that. I can feel it in my face where it's like, wow, that's an interesting kind of way he grabs those syllables.
Yeah.
That then informed the rest of the impression for me. And it was the same with Morgan Freeman. I remember hearing Morgan Freeman early, before Morgan Freeman was a well-known narrator. He was already a great actor, but he was not known as, oh, my God, the voice of Morgan Freeman. He was just like, oh, yeah, that great actor. There was some commercial for Seven.
Mm-hmm. The movie, yeah.
Yeah, the movie Seven. And where they extracted a line from the movie to use in the trailer. And he was saying, there are seven deadly sins. And I remember going, seven deadly sins. That's interesting. Maybe that's how. Oh, yeah. And I had that Morgan Freeman sound in my back pocket for years, and I could never sell it. You know, I mean, nobody was interested. I was said, well, you know, I could do that like Morgan Freeman. And they were like, yeah, you know, and they would say it quicker. and then one day I got an audition for the David Letterman show, and they said, we're looking for a Morgan Freeman sound alike for this Shawshank Redemption thing. And I went, leave it to me.
Got it.
And I got hired. And that was the beginning of a lot of Morgan Freeman knockoff stuff that I did for maybe 10 years for the Tonight Show and a couple other people. And yeah. And so you never know. I mean, you just you collect these sounds and you get a kind of a muscle memory for it. And every now and then it turns out to be a good thing to have.
I'm just so intrigued, too, about the idea of how voices change, too. And I heard you do a little bit of Jack Nicholson over the years. And I thought it was such a brilliant demonstration. And it was spot on, too, what I heard. Like his, and I didn't realize his voice had changed that much until I heard you talk about it.
Right. Well, and, you know, I remember very well Jack Nicholson was, he always sounded like he just woke up. But it was a more, obviously, he was in his 30s. He was a lot more spry. His voice had a certain quality that was the kind of voice that people used to imitate early on, this kind of performance. And then as he got a little older and more sure of himself, he relaxed into it a bit. His physicality changed and I think he felt he didn't have to push so hard. And then later on, of course, it changes quite a bit and he gets to be kind of husky. Now I saw him recently. He's retired, right? So I saw him recently out signing autographs, probably in front of his house or down at the Ventura Boulevard or something. Somebody said, hey, Jack, you going to do any more movies? He went, no. Just going to watch Laker games. So it's beautiful though. It's the beautiful instrument of a man's voice. And I listen back to my old recordings of my voice from my early days in TV and in commercials and stuff. And I you know, I kind of sound like this kind of guy, very, very bright and kind of, I don't know. It's just a whole different instrument.
Wow. Yeah.
I
just
it.
Read Sir Patrick Stewart read his book. And,
oh,
and
you did.
That was what got me thinking about this. And then I heard your bit and I'm like, his voice has changed so much. Yeah.
Yes, I no doubt it has. I mean, now when you hear Patrick Stewart, he's actually quite elderly. And I've been told a bit frail, which he has every right to be after all these years. I mean, if you don't have the right to be frail when you're in your 80s, I don't know when you'll get to cash in that particular coupon. But we remember him, of course, as being, you know, the very stentorian Patrick Stewart, the make it so Patrick Stewart, the Earl Grey tea hot.
Yeah.
And so it's, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Anthony Hopkins is the same way. All these guys are just fantastic. We just love those characters, you know, and maybe that's the secret of great stars, is that enough people see that person on the screen and go, all right, that's me, and I'm having this adventure, and I'm totally comfortable with that. That's me. He's moving. That's it. You know, I'm completely happy to be absorbed by that guy and be him for the next 2 hours. And we don't feel that way about everybody.
Yeah. As you got better and better and more into your craft as an impressionist, I'm curious to what degree you found that improv and like, I guess being able to be good with accents kind of helped and contributed to you being able to just kind of expand your repertoire.
Yeah. Well, improv really gave me a lot of stuff. It really started me off a lot to focus as an impressionist, because it was very useful to be in an improv company, to have a guy in the company that was just good at doing voices and playing different characters, so that I could be turned to and utilized in that way. And I was utilized in that way very vigorously. And since I had always had a great affinity for accents and peculiarities of speech and the musicality of different kind of ways of talking, which I definitely saw exhibited by my mom. I came kind of preloaded into the improv scene with a lot of useful things that an improv group helped to bring out, and weekly shows helped to bring out, and gosh, we just did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of live shows. And then the audience teaches you a lot, because they respond to certain things or they don't respond to certain things. And you go, wow, you know, they really liked this. And I should hunker down on that and do more of that to please more people, you know, in the room. So it all fortuitously worked together really nicely for me. And then I just built a lot of confidence. When you go out on stage, as improvisers know, and I'm not sure what your experience has been with it, but if you go out on a stage with nothing but your wits and a suggestion or two, and you do that over and over again, and it's perfectly fine and as successful as it needs to be, after a while, you just don't worry about that part of life. There are plenty of other parts of life that you could be worried about and sweat over, but the part on stage where someone says, okay, you're a grocer, and the guy that just came up to buy an apple is a Martian. Yeah. I'm good. 3 minutes, I have no worries.
I'm sure that's probably a muscle that just gets stronger, you know, the more you exercise it, like anything else.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a craft. Holy cow.
Well, it's a very human craft. And my wife teaches improv. She's teaching it tonight, as a matter of fact, at her school, the Acting Center, which is the best acting school in the country.
I've heard that.
And yeah, it's really good. And it's a very human art form. The only thing you have to train people in mainly is to agree with one another. And you wouldn't think that would be difficult, but it is exceedingly difficult. It's not impossible, and it is done every day successfully. But most of us come hardwired into any given group activity with a penchant to disagree, a definite gravitic pull towards no, and disagreement. And so you have to drill, 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 and get people to just say, you know, just try it. Just when he says, these pancakes taste good, just say, yeah, they really do. And you have, and people will go, these pancakes, no, I don't think they taste good. Okay, let's try it again. He says, the guy comes up and he says, it's a beautiful day. Look outside. Look at the birds chirping. God, it's all overcast. And what are those, buzzards? No, no, no. Just try it. Oh,
work
my
with
God.
Me here.
Work with me here is so interesting. And I don't know why that, what that means psychically, but it is very therapeutic to do improv for that reason, because you begin to kind of let go of the knee-jerk response of disagreement in any given situation. And I don't know any other area where of life where you can kind of observe that and pay attention to it and handle it, you know, and get it so it's no longer plaguing you, except in an improv class, a good one, where they teach it that way, and many do. And it's a beautiful thing. And then you start going around, and people who are studying improv, after a while, they go around, you know, I've been applying this yes and stuff, you know, where you say yes and just sort of agree with people. I've been doing that in life, and you won't believe it. It's just this amazing things are happening. You know, I just got invited to do this, and now I'm doing this. And it's like, oh, how about that?
It can be freeing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's enough negativity. You don't need to be in support of it, for sure. Yeah. Just, my goodness.
I got a lot out of it, and I'm very comfortable. I'm more comfortable improvising than I am learning the lines perfectly, actually, because that's like, you can do that wrong. That can be wrong.
Yeah.
The word can be, you know.
That makes sense.
But improvising, let's do it again.
I like that.
Me too.
You guys were talking about accents there for a second, and it made me wanted to ask. I suspect because of your skills, you can do quite a few accents. I'm curious if you can do them without attaching them to the people for which you learned them.
Oh, that's a good question.
Does that make sense?
it does. No, it absolutely makes sense, and in fact, it's a tremendous invasion of privacy. it's easier, certainly, and the way that I learn accents is by learning people.
Yeah.
So I think I have the ability to divorce myself that accent from an individual, but that takes a little bit of a conscious effort. It's more easy for me to, like, we talk about Patrick Stewart, all right, you know, this is a your standard RP sort of English, and I can do it without being Patrick Stewart as well, but then it starts to drift into other people, I think. But And you know, Yorkshire, when I think of Yorkshire, and of course Patrick Stewart came from Yorkshire, but it doesn't sound like that anymore unless he puts it on. But David Hockney still sounds like he's from Yorkshire completely. And so I'd have to extrapolate that out and just be a Yorkshire guy like that and somehow glean that those vowel sounds and so forth from Yorkshire, but drop all the husky David Hockney part, you know. So it can be done.
Did you ever have the chance to study language? Is that part of what got you interested or able to leverage some of this skill set?
I speak Spanish. I lived in Spain, so I studied Spanish. I'm not a polyglot. I wish I was. I admire language a lot, and that takes some real time.
Yeah.
And you either spend it studying or you spend it in the country that, you know, whose language you want to learn. And I spent quite a bit of time in Spain, but so I used to speak rather well. But I haven't traveled that much. Some people pick it up as a hobby. I find my hobby bandwidth is already taken up by all these other silly things I like to do. So I have precious little left. My friend Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater is a polyglot. He speaks many languages, and he's always telling me things like, well, you know, in Dutch, the word is welcome. And you're like, oh, really? That's good. Yeah. And it relates to, because the Danish say it a little bit differently. And in Russian, it's amazing. But he just, you know, he picks up that stuff, and he's, of course, a genius. So that helps. He's probably got a lot more bandwidth than I do in general.
I know I reached out to you when we were preparing for this, and I asked you if you did any impressions of anybody on Parks and Rec. And you mentioned a little bit of Ron Swanson.
A little bit of Ron Swanson, the great Nick Offerman, who is a terrific actor, I think, in general. And that character of Ron Swanson is one that's, I think, one of the great release valves of the show. Whenever somebody gets too moronic, he's right there to sort of burst the balloon, let all the air out in a way that is self-deprecating, but at the same time, intensely masculine.
I love
and
it.
Nick is, so true. Nick is a great, he's a great, and he directed a couple of the shows that I was in. I think I was in both shows that he directed. I don't know.
More okay. than just a couple. Yeah, he directed two, if I recall. So
yeah. I was in both those shows. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great. So
that is great. Yeah. Nick Offerman is totally my man crush on the show. And for our podcast, we do like funny little, well, we think they're funny, funny little.
We're the only ones.
We're the only ones. And I typically do, well, my version of Ron Swanson. So it's, yeah, he's a fun character.
Well, let's typically hear it.
Oh, gosh.
What's your favorite? You have a favorite line?
I've never heard Mark do this live. I've got to be honest. I always get the recording.
Well, and Jim, something that you said really, you know, emanated with me is that, you know, I always get into it like, you got to clear that because it's very serious. Hello, this is Ron Swanson. Today, I am going to JJ's Diner because I am going to have my meal of bacon and eggs. And it's really, I don't know. You know that who I'm trying to do now. If that's a good impression,
good.
I don't know.
That's very good. I think you're super close. It's great. Yeah, he definitely evokes that character.
He's assertive in what he says because he doesn't give a damn about what you think about what he's saying.
Right.
I am going to do this now because it is my prerogative as a human being.
I am telling you this because everybody else but me is quite silly.
Yep.
All right, I'll stop.
No, that's great. You planted a flag in the soil. That's very good.
Yeah, Ron is our frequent, he does all of our commercials for our podcast. So we,
nice.
Yeah, we've done what, I don't know, Mark, 50 fake commercials or so now in 4 years.
70.
At least 70,
yeah.
I don't know. We do them for us. I don't know if anybody else enjoys them, but we like them. So
right.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I know we always ask people where we can find you, and I was kind of looking at what maybe is newer for you. And tell us a little bit about, one, I heard your impersonation of Chris O'Dowd, who I love, and you're getting to work with him. So how's that?
Well, I have the honor of portraying his father in a show called The Big Door Prize, which is on Apple TV Plus. And it's a lot of fun. It's a weird, weird show. I won't lie. It's peculiar. Modern kind of show, but a comedy. And Chris O'Dowd is always very funny. I think he's very charming and amusing and also just a terrific actor. I mean, he's really, really good.
Yeah.
And so I've been very fortunate to have a small part. You know, it's not really, unfortunately, I wish it was, a show about Chris O'Dowd and his dad. His dad features in very lightly in the show, but he is there. And so that's The Big Door Prize on Apple TV Plus. We just dropped our second season, so you'll see me pop
good.
In.
Nice.
Yeah, and my character, it actually has changed my life quite a bit because I got the role during the pandemic, and they said the character is an accountant who, because of the show, if you know the conceit of the show, a fortune-telling machine suddenly appears in the general store, and people start getting these little... Yeah, you know, they engage the machine. They put their palm down and on the thing, and it collects all their data, a lot of very personal data, and spits out a little blue card that tells them what their true potential is and what their destiny is, essentially. And it's generally something that they're not doing at all in their life. And in my character's case, he is an accountant, and he gets a card that says male model. And this indicates to him, and he's like, you know, is this really right? I'm changing my life because all my life I've really had this sort of hidden desire to be a male model. So he stops, he closes down his accountancy firm and does like little events around the town of, it's a town probably not much bigger than Pawnee. And Deerfield, it's called Deerfield.
no particular state even. We don't know where it is. And so, you know, I show up. And so when I got the job, they said, hey, you're in pretty good shape. But not for nothing. If you want to work out with a personal trainer, we will hire a trainer for you. And I went, free stuff? You bet.
Yeah.
And they hired a dialect coach for me. And I worked with him a little bit. And that was a lot of fun. I'd never worked with a professional dialect coach before. Right. And that was super fun. And I started working out and with a trainer. And I've kept it going because I am, for the first time in my life, I'm like, and which is a good time in my 60s to be concentrating more on my physical fitness. Sure. So I go a couple times a week and work out and lift weights. And my wife isn't complaining and I feel better. And it's all good.
You.
So the show has changed my life in many, many ways. And I just would hope that in season 3, that there is some longer, larger arc with the father of the Chris O'Dowd character. I think that would be quite profitable.
I think it's what the fans are demanding, in fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's get those kids out there with their pitchforks and their torches.
That's right.
And in the meantime, I'm doing my one-man show, Gympressions, in Los Angeles about once a month. Mm-hmm. And any of your listeners or viewers who are in the LA area, I'm going to do one actually this Sunday, May 19th, and then maybe one in June, July, about once a month, as I say. And you can always find out about it at jimmeskimen.com. I also promote it on Instagram all the time. I'm very active on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've watched a lot of your Instagram and what you put on YouTube, and it's all very enjoyable. So we definitely push people in that direction.
For Thank sure. you. Yeah. In the last week or so, I've had two legitimately viral Instagram hits. You know, one has 3 million views in a week.
Wow.
It's like,
wow.
And then, you know, and then I'll do another one and I'll work really hard and put it up and I'll think this is really clever. And then, you know, 10,000 people will watch it. And you're like, well, what does that have?
That doesn't make sense.
Don't make sense.
Yeah. We've looked at analytics and I just never understand them.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So I did a Christopher Walken thing just recently, and that's the one that exploded. And it was just something my daughter asked me to do. She's sort of in charge of my social media. So, boom. and then the other one, what was the other one? I think I had a Patrick Stewart one that went a bit viral as well. Mm-hmm. So I do him and Robin Williams, of course. I'm always doing Robin, little bits here and there, trying to keep that alive, keep that spirit alive.
Yeah, all amazing.
Absolutely.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a hoot, and really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. You guys gave a great interview. I feel very, very comforted and supported. Thank you.
Well, Appreciate that. Well, Jim, take care. We'll be on the lookout for what you have out there next.
Okie dokie.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Take care. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Everybody, we're back. Well, Mark, that was just as good as I remembered it. So we had a great full hour talking to Jim and covered a lot of stuff, but I was fascinated with everything he said, basically.
I was too. It's, you know what, with someone like that, with a talent like that, it's so easy for me at least to get so focused on like an aspect like his great vocal mimicry abilities. But I mean, his talents really lie so much deeper than that as well.
And I thought it was interesting too. You know, he seems to have a love for dramatic acting. And in the intro, you'd asked me the first time I saw him was Parks and Rec. And while I said that was true, I think it's not. I think the first time I saw him, but I wouldn't have known him as an actor, a standalone actor, was probably in Apollo 13. Which predates Parks and Rec by a couple of years, but you know, and how he got that role and, you know, his relationship to Ron Howard through his mom and, you know, but obviously I think he enjoys those challenges as well. He's not just a voice actor, much like Mary Faber, who we had on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. She does a lot of voiceover work as well.
Absolutely.
And I just think that whole field is fascinating. I mean, especially now that, you know, everything is on the wide, wide world of web there.
I know.
But holy cow.
Well, maybe you should look into that in your second career here. You could kind of do a little bit of a reset and become a voice actor.
Maybe I could actually learn to do it well. And maybe one day if I could do one or two voices well, maybe that might be a thing.
There you go. Know? Well, yeah. I thought you fared well in the Swanson off there. So,
ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you're ever going to hear that phrase anywhere else. Uh-huh. We had a Swanson off.
We had a Swanson off. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is like I feel like his Ron Swanson, his Nick Offerman is spot on.
Yes, it is.
Our version's a little cartoonish, but we do that. We do it on purpose, right? Like, I don't think that takes away from your performance. I think it's something we've been doing for fun all along and on the show, and I think everyone's figured that out by now. And if they didn't know that you do the voice, now they do. But you know, it's
yeah.
I think short
peek
of
behind the curtains.
Yeah, well, there you go, behind the scenes. Short of actually seeing the character. I think that, you know, we actually talked about it to Jim there. You know, it's a bit of a caricature, right? And
that's a great way to put it.
I think that's often the lazy man's way to do a voice. But in our case, yes, we kind of do it on purpose, I think, because, we have nothing visual to present.
Right. Right. The last thing we would want is for some yahoo like me to be doing a voice and for the audience to go, who the hell is that?
What is that?
Like, okay, yeah. is it a spot on? Yeah. Can I do Nick Offerman as well as Jim Eskman? Absolutely not.
No.
But you at least know who it is
that's
I'm
right.
doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Now, how well you do it's still up for discussion.
I know.
And we've had people weigh in on that, haven't we?
Oh yes. No reason to be mean. We have.
I don't care. Like I say about everything we do, I know we enjoy it and we hope you enjoy it. And if you don't, please keep that to yourself. Well, regardless of anything, Mark, I really enjoyed that interview. Jim was a super nice guy to talk to, and it took a few minutes to get that all set up. But once we got him, he was a terrific guest, just like all of our guests have been.
Absolutely. I mean, as you said in our interview with Mara Marini, you know, we've had a lucky streak and this one did not break it. We've been really fortunate.
Yeah, we really have. And if that's our last interview, I'll be very happy with everything we've done to date. I don't think it will be. I know we're working on a couple of final ones as we wrap up the show here.
Right.
You know, over these many, many 6 months and to do three episodes. And we'll see what we come up with. But like I said, I'm proud of what we've done. We've certainly enjoyed it and we hope you guys have enjoyed listening to it.
Absolutely. I agree.
Well, thank you, Mark. We appreciate everyone listening and we look forward to next time.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Live from Pawnee is a copyrighted production of the creators. Copyright 2020. All rights reserved. Original music was created and performed by Aaron Emerson of Emerson Studios. Clips are used under fair use doctrine for the purpose of commentary and parody. Please see our website at livefrompawnee.com for more details or to contact us.